Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, we're continuing our conversation, is with poet-songwriter Jack Crocker. And we're talking about his second collection of poems, The Algorithm of I. Jack, it's a pleasure to be talking to you again. And thanks so much for being on again.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here again.
One of the things I want to talk to you about, and this is something I've been meaning to talk to other poets about, but you do this, is about teaching poetry. Now, you teach poetry and creative writing, correct?
Yeah, I did. I'm full-time administration now, and not teaching, but that was the area that I taught for many years, yes.
To me, it seems like teaching people how to be humorous. It's really, I envision it because I've taught art, visual art, but poetry and creative writing seems like, especially in this day and age where many people don't read, it seems like it's a real challenge, is it?
You mentioned read. My approach was, I didn't teach really how to write poetry. I think that, you know, you develop that, you have a talent for it. It's like music talent to me, and I don't know that creativity can be taught. That's always a question that's asked. So I always say, you know, I'm going to teach you reading. And my approach was to look at, you know, the best poems and start with them and then undress them, just take them down to, well, you know, how does it work? If this language affected you, what is it about the poem that works, and how did it do it? And so we go through different kinds of poems, and you have the different attitudes and the different interests. But I also point out the magic that, think about, we have 26 little squiggly lines. And out of that, think of the genius of that. Out of those 26 squiggly lines, you got Shakespeare. You got the Bible. You know, and so that's what you have to work with. That's the tool that you have. You have the alphabet, and you have language, and that's what poetry is.
Did you stick with mostly 20th century works to have them read, or did you go back to, like, the Romantic period and before?
No, I would go back, especially, I felt that you know, so many, especially now the free verse or open forms was the thing they would go to, but I wanted, I always required students to write in form. They had to write sonnets.
Nice.
They had to write terzarima. They had to understand what poetry is capable of before they could do their own. And I would use the metaphor that, you know, it's like being a carpenter. You have to know what a hammer's for. You have to know what a saw is for. And if you don't, then, you know, you're losing out on the tools that are available to you. So I would always have students write in forms.
That's really interesting. I was just before you, I was interviewing a sculptor who does installation work. And I was asking her, is that a real challenge to you, that, you know, you're going into a space? And she said it was the restrictions of the space that really forced her to be really more creative. And I think that's an analogy when you're talking about, you know, writing in whatever form you're choosing in poetry. That challenge of that structure is what really brings about your deeper imagination.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I usually would say that the economic system of poetry is less is more. And you simply start squeezing down, and so consequently the value lies in finding the right words, and so the that's what you do. And the other is, you know, so many beginning would-be poets think that they're writing from the blood that runs through their heart. And so once they get a first draft down, I wrote that with my blood. I can't change it.
I know that feeling from my way back in my youth. It's like, this is the pure form of my expression. Don't mess with it.
Exactly. And no, you don't dare ask me to rewrite this or to say that this line doesn't work or that word doesn't work. I mean, it's sacred.
That's a tough lesson to learn.
Yeah, you have to get used to rewriting. And but also, if you haven't read and you don't know what's possible,
right,
then you just fall into all of the cliches again. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways, sort of thing.
and this brings up another point. I feel like a lot of people today, including people who are friends of mine, they don't, because reading is not like what it once was, to make a poetic simile or metaphor, like let's say Sisyphus, and you, I think that the poem you wrote about crackers. You have to know that. You have to know the myth of Sisyphus to understand why that's a cool poem. That seems to be not as much common, knowledge anymore, that people even understand how to use that information.
Yeah, that's true. But, you think of the Eliot School, where you had to know all of classical literature in order to get
right.
all of the references. That he has, and certainly the more connections you can make, because oftentimes the poets are working, where words do more than just function as meaning in a poem. So where I think when I say the best words, those are the words that do multiple duty. So they're going to have, the meaning of the word, but they're also going to connect to other things outside that word that takes you into the more meaning and more richness. And that's difficult for students to get. Eliot said that oftentimes when he was talking about how difficult his poetry could be, is that, well, you read it, and oftentimes you feel it before you understand it, and so I think sometimes there is that kind of subliminal response to how the language works on you, even though you don't get all of the references or you don't understand everything that's in there.
When you grew up in the rural South, right?
Right.
Did you have poetry classes that really starred you off down this road?
Yeah, as I mentioned, it's one of those typical stories. I had a fantastic English teacher.
It makes all the difference in the world.
Went to high school, and she had us reading poetry. I think it's probably changed now, but we started with usually with the Romantics.
Yep.
And as a blooming teenager, that kind of attitude and rebellion, really spoke to me. I started that. And the other in the South, and especially in a rural area, in my interest in music, I also, had that rich background of hymns in the church, which is the best of those hymns are really good poetry. And then I also, growing up in the Mississippi Delta, I had the blues. What a lot of people don't understand, the blues are so rich in innuendo and metaphors that at the time white people didn't really understand at times.
But that's also about language, though. The blues are really about the use of language. And sometimes in a subversive way. But
Ferry Lewis has the best lines on racial oppression. Ferry Lewis, a blues singer out of Memphis, one of the lines in his song was, "The judge charges me with forgery, and I can't even write my name." So you know, you have those great lines. In the blues.
So when did you decide that you did? You've done so many things in your life. I mean, you were a recording artist and all sorts of other things. At what point in your life did you decide, you know, I'm a poet too?
It's interesting. I never really gave up. There's something once you have that infection, it won't leave you alone. And so I kept reading, and then as I went through graduate school, you know, got more and more, got deeper into the whole area of literature. And there was a period. One of the things that you have to face is, if I'm going to be a poet, can I accept being mediocre?
Huh.
And because when you go up against the greats, then you say, why should I write if I'm wanting recognition, if I'm wanting fame? So am I going to just huddle back into my own psychological kind of a moaning stuff? Rodney Jones, who's a very fine poet, Southern poet out of Alabama, has a good many volumes and really a fantastic poet. In one of his poems, he had a great line, and he was talking about, you know, how do you come up against, how do you keep your faith in being a poet when you're up against all of the greats? And his line was, at some point you have to pretend that no poems have ever been written, and you're the first one to do it. So.
That, I have a saying that it's the easiest thing in the world to write bad poetry.
Oh, yeah.
and to write good poetry is a huge deal. And that's another thing. Did you teach students, or this didn't even come into it, how to tell the difference between a mediocre poet, a mediocre poem, and a good poem?
Yeah, that's really, really difficult, because there are some poems that are considered great that you would say,
they haven't aged well at all. A lot of romantic poetry.
Explain to me why you think that is so great. But the whole value, you know, the whole value system. But one thing about poetry now, from rap, to classical poetry, it comes in so many forms that you can't really box it into into one thing and say this is the great box, or because you have to look at the purpose of the poem that's out there, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. James Dickey claimed that he would rewrite a poem 50, 60 times. And at some point, does it become different poems as you're going through? And in many, many instances, it does. So.
I was going to say, like, that initial impetus for writing the poem, once you've rewritten it 60 times, it seems like you're doing a more formal exercise, and you have to balance the two things out.
Yeah, and at what point does it become an exercise? I did an interview with Galvin Cannell a good many years ago, who's one of my favorite poets and a major 20th century poet, and he had a poem. He started out writing in closed forms, and he had a poem that I'd read several times, and finally it hit me. He had the rhyme scheme in the penultimate syllable of the word. So the rhyme didn't occur at the end of the word. It occurred in the next to the last syllable.
Wow.
in the word. And when I said, and I may have been, one of the ones that hadn't noticed that, but I said, well, when you do that, does it that simply becomes a tour de force. It becomes kind of an exercise.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, he said, in a way, you know, it becomes a challenge, but he says it's still a poem.
and I guess there's nothing wrong with that. You know, why not just show off?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, doing quick things on the violin or really showing out on your guitar licks or whatever. So.
I'm so glad you mentioned rap, because I tell you, rap really brought me back to poetry. I've become enamored. Really good and well done rap, and there's a lot of it. My mouth is always agape at the use of language, because it's so smart. It swings too. It's got a beat, and it freaks me out sometimes about how good it is.
Yeah, I mean, you have that. Not only do you have the music and the rhythm, but the rhyming is absolutely genius at times.
I know, and the word usage is just brilliant.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
You're listening to WICN.
I think Shakespeare would have been an excellent rapper.
Yeah, but none of the romantics. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry by Dames Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, returning, is poet, songwriter, teacher, Jack Crocker. And we're talking about his second collection of poems, The Algorithm of I. And I really strongly recommend it. Hey, Jack, this is the first book of the newly formed Mimbrous Press.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about what the mission of the press is? It's from Western New Mexico University.
Yeah, so the Members Press of Western New Mexico University, the name comes from the Members Valley here. And there's a long ancient civilization that was here, known for its pottery. And in fact, our university museum has the largest collection of Members pottery in the world. So that's how we came up with the name. But it's also, mission is really to publish works of art in our region, although we aren't limited. I mean, if we get what we think is a Pulitzer Prize level book or something, then we're certainly interested in it. But indigenous literature, our certainly multicultural population here, we have a lot of creativity. In Silver City, where the university is a little town of under 10,000 people, and there are 25 art galleries here in the little town. So there's a really robust creative spirit in this area of New Mexico and across the state. So the president, Joe Shepherd, is also, although he's a mathematician, he's interested in literature because of me to a certain extent. Decided to start this press to serve that kind of creative force within our area.
Could I ask you to read a poem from this collection?
Yes.
Your choice.
We're talking about writing poetry, and I have a section in the Algorithm of I that's called Artifice, and there's a poem called Poetry Lesson, and it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, but it's intended to be humorous as well as I think some direction given. It's in six sections. So Poetry Lesson, section one. The poem is too accessible, the editor said, which I had come to learn meant it was too transparent, or more simply, too easy to understand, assuming there was meaning for which to hunt. For example, he said, the central image is a tree, but, well, it appears to remain just a tree. He was an Elliot Poundman, and at the time, I was into Billy Collins and the magic of the mundane. I had spent most of the poem describing the factual account of raking the leaves and what I found underneath, from a broken, creepy doll my daughter lost to colonies of bugs I could not name, except for ants. He, the editor, had said there was no turn at the end to make it more than it is. But he missed my intent, which is easy to do, especially editors who don't read a poem all the way through. The end turned to time is in the autumn of my life. I imagined when I was gone, the leaves would continue to fall for the next human to rake. Section 2. As poets are prone to do, so full of self-doubt, distrusting even the original muse, I embarked upon the inevitable second draft. I created a stream of sun to spotlight the undressed limbs, brought in the music of its roots in concert with neighbor trees, and added the orchestral arrangements of the birds that stopped in to sing. And even a side comment, how at night the tree became a nest of stars serenaded by the wind. My intent, I think, was to symbolize some sort of sacred musical brotherhood, a nature-human duet. Section 3. My wife, the real critic, read the new poem and was not impressed. Just like a narcissistic man, she said, you use the tree to talk about yourself. Why not let the tree be a tree? There's no meaning except what it is. Why not let the tree use you? I wasn't sure what she meant, but it seemed profound. After my usual creative pout, I entered the ring for the third round. Section 4. Less is usually more, and I know the best poems are squeezed and squeezed until compressed into a polished stone that leaks no air, just a solid mass that reflects. I started pruning until only one word was left. Here's the poem now, tree. Section 5. For the editor, this may not be enough, and probably not for you. A scientist may claim misfired neurons led me astray, or the God-striven failure once again to get inside the truth. But the tree is not its name, nor the poem a tree. Section 6. This autumn, go out to your favorite tree and rake the leaves, then pause and kneel to receive what it gives.
I love that poem. And the reason is because it's about writing a poem.
Yeah, and the poem actually, embedded in it is the writing of a poem.
Right.
So it's a poem within a poem kind of thing. Also, when you look at it, when I say less is more, each section becomes shorter.
I noticed that.
Until you get down to the last one, which is a couplet. So,
you're left with...
Fun to do.
And it ends up, it was like almost like one of those art projects where the artist just lists what you should do, and then you go out and do
yeah.
it. Go out and write your own poem. Go out and rake some leaves. It's such a revealing poem about the process of having to really go through this. We only have a few minutes left. There's so many things I wanted to talk to you about. There's a poem, I think it's Male Fantasies. It has the names of Clayton Moore, for those of you who don't remember or not old enough to remember, was the original TV Lone Ranger. Lash LaRue. I just saw a Lash LaRue movie not too long ago. Now, I have to ask you, is Busty Lamont a real person?
No, I made up the name.
But it's great.
the name was made up, but it worked to what I was trying to work, because the poem ends, you know, the male fantasies, it's a play, the M-A-I-L also is a play on the M-A-L-E as well, because at the end of the poem, of course, Busty Lamont enters my life in the Sears and Roebuck catalog.
Well, and that brings up the erotic in poetry too, because you have some interesting erotic lines. I think it's in First Lust, and then my penis became aware of Becky Fowler. Now I got to ask you, was there a real Becky Fowler, or did you change the name?
Well, I changed the name, but there was a real...
Oh, there really was a Becky Fowler.
Yes, yeah. Also, I needed Fowler actually worked into the rhyme scheme, so that worked as well.
Now, before you go, you actually did a artist residency in Florence, Italy.
Yes, I taught creative writing there, yeah.
What was that like? I mean, and especially for a poet and a writer, Florence looms large because of Dante.
Florence is one of my favorite. Actually, I had this experience one day. I had been there when I was in graduate school at Florida State. Florida State has a Florentine program. I was there for a semester in graduate school. But when I went back teaching a semester for another university, I had one day was walking down the street near the Duomo, and I had this really feeling come over me that, man, I've walked here before.
Oh, whoa.
And so for some reason, Florence seems my spiritual home, and I go back every chance I get. But I was teaching American students for the university, but man, what a rich a rich landscape as well as history, so that we could go into the Uffizi, and I would ask them, you know, to write poems on art and that sort of thing. So it really was a fantastic
experience. My God. Well, we're completely out of time, and we still have so much more to talk about. My guest tonight has been poet, teacher, songwriter, Jack Crocker, and we've been talking about his second collection of poems, very recommended, The Algorithm of I. Jack, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Mark, once again.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.